Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. He also writes for Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. A great guest always, a great writer, and somebody who can make things easy enough to understand. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also go to Facebook, WAMC Radio on Facebook, and you'll find a Vox Pop post there. You can comment. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. You can also go to our website, wamc.org/voxpop. There's a spot to leave a question or a comment there. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray. It's a pleasure to be here.
You made it back from the beautiful dark skies of Chile.
Oh, Chile is so great. Yep, that was fabulous last week.
And so, any new discoveries?
Oh, no. We bring a group down and just take advantage of those dark skies and sniff around in the desert and the mountains and just a lot of fun. Thanks.
Good. And I trust you had clear skies.
We did, yeah. Sunny there.
Based on the writings in your latest book, something else I didn't know, that it's clear there 300 days a year or thereabout.
Right.
That's good.
And that's why I snuck that into Zoom. And Zoom, of course, is about motion. And that's a place where everything's going backwards. You know, the sun goes the wrong direction across the sky. By that, I mean that if you go in for lunch and come out here, the sun has moved to the right of where it was before. And we don't really think about that, but we feel it. We sense it.
Yeah.
But down there, after an hour, you've been inside a house, you come back, the sun is left of where it was. It moves leftward across the sky. And so it just feels, you sense it on a gut level that something's screwy down there.
Well, Rosetta is coming to a conclusion. We hope it'll be the first successful soft landing on an icy body out in space. The landing on the comet is due for, I believe, the 12th of November.
Next Wednesday, yes.
So, and we'll be seeing that live all over the place, right?
That's right. And very, very exciting. I think this is the most exciting thing we've done, we meaning humans, since the Cassini program started orbiting Saturn fully 10 years ago. This is just absolutely amazing.
Now, the Cassini program and related probes are focusing on the moons quite often, yes?
That's right, because each of these worlds, such as Saturn's, have fabulous moons.
Big moons, Titan, some of them.
Titan, giant, and has an atmosphere of mostly nitrogen, just like ours, although it's colder. Enceladus, that has geysers of water and ice streaming up, showing that it's got under-surface water. So, yeah, just fabulous places. But speaking of water, that's what the comet is. So comets are, we used to say, dirty snowballs, thanks to Fred Whipple's creation of that famous phrase. Then he was used, for the Charmin commercials. We talked about that. But it was Fred Whipple, the comet expert, who called them dirty snowballs. Now we think of it more like a snowy dirt ball, that it's mostly perhaps stones and dust with ice holding it together. But as the comet could only be a couple of miles across, as this one is, not round, kind of peanut-shaped or shaped like a piece of ginger root, comes towards the sun. That ice sublimates, the dust gets released, the solar wind blows the tail backward, and we're going to watch it to actually land on this thing with high-definition cameras and have another orbiter all around it, and then to watch this process in action as the comet approaches its closest approach with the sun, or perihelion, next August 3rd, I believe it is.
And you've mentioned that it is not an orb. It is an oddly shaped thing. And so they spent a great amount of time and effort finding a spot that looks like a good landing spot, and I think they've named it.
That's right. Of course, you've got to name it, even if you had a little bit of trash-filled vacant lot and something was going to happen there, you'd give it a name. That's what we do. We name things. So I don't even know how to pronounce it because it was just announced. I'll spell it out, A-G-I-L-K-I-A. We're just getting used to the other.
Agilkia?
That's right. This is, you know, it's the European Space Agency, the ESA, who did this, and hats off to them. And even the name of the aircraft that's doing the landing has an odd name, P-H-I-L-A. So that one spelled more like fillet.
These are all Egyptian names from history and mythology and such.
Right.
Well, before we get to the calls, 1-800-348-2551. I ought to clue the listeners in on an interesting conversation we had prior to the program. And that was about the nature of time. And I brought up this article that was on our website, WAMC.org. It was under the Science and Technology header, if you want to find it there. It is entitled, New Clock May End Time as We Know It. And it's all about a new clock that's strontium-based. But I got to page 2 of this article, and I thought of Bob Berman immediately. Here's the segment of that. Time Undone is the subject. Right now, on the top of Mount Everest, time is passing just a little bit faster than it is in Death Valley. That's because speed at which time passes depends on the strength of gravity. Einstein himself discovered this dependence as part of his theory of relativity, and it is a very real effect. Here's the paragraph 2 that blows my mind to some extent. The relative nature of time isn't just something seen in the extreme. If you take a clock off the floor and hang it on the wall, time will speed up by about one part in 10 to the 16th. What?
That's right. But when we say time will speed up, I noticed in the article is Tom O'Brien, who's in charge of the atomic clocks of America. He's out at the National Institute of Standards and Technology out in Boulder. I had the pleasure when I was doing a talk for them a couple of years ago of having lunch with Tom, and I asked him the question, what do you think time is? And he straightforwardly said, we have no idea. We have no idea what time is. And I see in this article he's now sort of given an opinion now. He says, my own personal opinion is that time is a human construct. And with that, I would say absolutely right.
But then how could it move faster if you put a clock on the wall as opposed to on the floor?
Because it's not really moving. Rather, sequential events, cyclical events that repeat themselves will repeat themselves at a different rate relative to the others. By itself, it doesn't have any independent existence. Although I'll tell you, Ray, this has been debated against smart people have been arguing this for centuries. You had Isaac Newton, who believed the time was real. That was a real separate item, what we might now call a separate dimension, a construct, a container that events move through. But other smart people, like Immanuel Kant, argue that no, it's a human idea. It's like our numbering system. It's something we create so that we can make sense of things, that we can make order from the electrical signals that are rushing through our brains all the time and kind of making a sequence there. And if that's true, then there is no container that objects move through. And if this is true, you certainly could never travel through time. It's just a way we structure things. So when they're talking about this, Ray, what it means is that if you look at something that repeats, like a pendulum or a candle burning down, and compare that with the rate that another object does its thing, the rates will vary from depending upon where the object is, what kind of...
With relation to the center of gravity? Or?
Exactly. Gravity slows down time, and that's why higher up, like the summit of Mount Everest, time would move faster than in Death Valley. Plus, your speed famously changes time, so that if you could travel at 99% of the speed of light, your time would travel... only 1/7 as fast as those who weren't at that speed. But it doesn't mean that just because clocks are moving at different rates, it doesn't mean that there's really such a thing as time. It just means that the rates of things happening change.
All right, let's go to the phones, get one in here before the break. 1-800-348-2551. Jeff in Gardner, New York. Jeff, you're on.
Oh, Ray and Dr. Berman, good afternoon, and thanks very much for taking my call.
My pleasure, thanks.
I had a chance to hear you speak, Dr. Berman, a couple times locally, and I just wanted to say that the show that you do on light, the nature of the colors of light, that was so wonderfully... it's such a wonderful explanation. I really appreciated it.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate that. I'm going to do that again in Ottawa about a month from now.
It's lucky people that's going to be in that room.
You're very kind. Thank you.
So on the walkway, and you were answering the question of in what direction are we moving right now? And I was troubled by that, and I ended up coming up with an analogy. I just wonder if you think this was a worthwhile analogy. It's a pitcher on the pitching mound takes out his marker and puts a little black dot on the ball and then throws a big curve ball towards the catcher. Now, if you were trying to describe in what direction is that dot on the ball moving, because the ball's turning and moving and curving. I mean, isn't that kind of an analogy, too, about in what direction are we moving right now?
Yeah, absolutely. You always have to specify relative to what. Now, here on Earth, it's pretty easy because if you say a snail is crawling at one-third of a mile an hour tops, and by the way, I think that's wrong. That wouldn't be the speed. But we all know what we're talking about relative to the ground that it's moving on, so you don't have to specify. But in your case, when you're talking about something that's spinning and moving forward, the way we are here in the region that most of our listeners are in, we're moving about 700 miles an hour. As we rotate, we're also moving 18 and a half miles per second as we go around the sun. And meantime, the sun, carrying the Earth with it, is moving 144 miles per second around the center of the galaxy. So if somebody said, how are you really moving? You'd say, relative to what?
Right. And the galaxy's moving as well, and so are the others. We'll take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Back in a flash.
Support comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont. Off the Shelf with Norman Lear presenting Even This I Get to Experience, November 29th at 7 p.m. Northshire.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years, from digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more, paradisecopies.com. And the Cheese Traveler, Albany, New York, featuring over 100 cheeses, cured meats, grilled cheese sandwiches, Tilldale Farm organic beef and pork, artisan pantry items, and cheese classes. TheCheeseTraveler.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, along with astronomer Bob Berman, and you. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. James in Monroe, New York. James, you're on.
Hi, I love the show. I wait every month to hear it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think I lost the wind of my sail. I was going to ask if time, I know, is a conception, but if there was a time before the Big Bang.
Well, that's a great question, and there's different ways to answer it, that even if you don't consider time to be a real separate entity, but just something that we animals or we humans use to make sense of things, if we're not around, does it exist independent of us? And presumably we were not before the Big Bang. Another way to answer it is that if there was nothingness, if indeed there is such a thing as nothingness, and you have no change, no energies, no objects that are changing position, what would be the meaning of time if there was absolutely no change? So it would be meaningless. And there's different ways of tackling that, and then the answer depends upon how far out and wacky and new agey, or as Ray would say, how lava lampy you want to get with that. There are some who believe that consciousness or the observer and the universe go hand in hand, that they're symbiotic or correlative. And if that's the case, if there really is no such thing as a universe without an observer together, and quantum theory is pointing more and more in that direction, then again, you've got the Big Bang, and there was no real time when there was nothingness. So,
doesn't that make everything meaningless? If there was nothing that is permanent, that is beyond us, in other words, if it is all a construct or at least only around when we observe it, then isn't everything meaningless?
You know, you're looking really good. You've lost some weight, I think.
Cut it out.
No, I'm just trying to change the topic because I can't answer that question about whether everything is meaningless.
All right, fine. Well, James, go ahead.
Could I ask one more?
Yeah.
Well, because an observation I made is that things, it is a construct of some sort because like a fruit fly will live his whole life cycle so many days and compared to us, but yet it's a whole life cycle. So, and then I get lost in the thought about in a vacuum, is there time, is there gravity? I get lost in them two thoughts when I put them together.
Well, the gravity in a vacuum is another story, because gravity, even though it's the most mysterious of the four fundamental forces in the universe, certainly exists in a vacuum. We're orbiting in a near vacuum in space, and we're being pulled around the sun by either gravity or the distortion of space-time, depending upon what model of gravity you want to use.
What a vacuum, I'm talking about a complete vacuum with nothing in it, because space is maybe a partial vacuum, but it's full of stuff.
You know, you're so right. And the more we look into this, the more stuff we're finding. Virtual particles, that is antimatter, and their matter analogs popping in and out of nothingness all the time.
Matter.
Yeah, there seems to be, which we don't even know what that is. But yes, there seems to be lots of stuff that pervades seeming nothingness.
I think it comes down to basically fate. I don't know.
Faith?
It seems like there's. We're from stardust. We're from stars. And stars came from the Big Bang. If there's nothing from the Big Bang, you have faith. I don't think there's any difference between religion and science. I think they're all one thing. It's just that it's your perception.
I like it. James, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. So if things are popping in and out of nothingness all the time, and what we perceive to be a vacuum is not empty, then does nothingness exist?
We used to think so when the idea of an ether was dispensed with about a century ago. It used to be thought of, how can light travel through the emptiness of space, Ray, if without a propagating material? Sound needs air, otherwise it would be silent. So what does light need? And we thought that some kind of ether was there. Once that was dispensed with, then we thought that, well, it's nothingness. But now we've gone the other way, and we're seeing that in addition to electrical and magnetic fields, there are and dark energy or a vacuum energy that seems to pervade the universe. There's and neutrinos that are everywhere. Mm. You know, every second, 1 trillion neutrinos goes through each of your fingernails.
Yes.
So they're omnipresent as well. So there's lots of stuff, even if we can't perceive it.
Okay. All right. Well, it's 2:27. My head's spinning. Jim and Rensselaer. Jim, you're on.
Hi, Ray. This sort of bounces off of what you were just saying about popping out of nothingness. Monday night, I was driving north on Route 22. I was somewhere south of the town of Patterson.
Oh, yeah.
And I could see through the trees this sort of phenomenon happening. So I pulled up to the Watchtower Education Center, where there's a clear horizon to the northwest, sort of south. And there were these concentric circles starting out sort of on a dot way off in the horizon, and they would grow out to a certain limit, and then they disappear. This went on for about 3 or 4 minutes, and I was wondering, Doc, is there any sort of phenomenon like that that you're aware of?
No, there isn't, and I just wish, when I hear reports like that, I wish I had been with you. I wish you could have tapped me on the shoulder and said, look at that, so I could have said, oh, no, that's just planes coming into Albany Airport, or that's just diffraction off a cloud, or said, I have no idea. That's a puzzling one.
Yeah.
But I'll just to let you know, it doesn't mean anything. But in all these years of observing the sky, and I'm also a pilot and I've flown a lot at night, I've yet to see anything that was unidentified in the sky. But I hear reports such as yours from seemingly very sober and normal people. So that certainly I can't explain without seeing it myself. So we'll just have to write that up as a mystery.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Jeff in Hyde Park. Jeff, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I had been told by somebody they read on a social media in regards to solar flares that mid-December we're supposed to have some massive solar flares, which then hence will cause a solar dust storm, which then would prevent sunlight from coming. So it would be somewhat of an eclipse in a way. have you heard anything about this? And if not, is it possible?
No, we're not going to have any kind of normal eclipses, certainly, in December. None of the sun, none of the moon. But solar flares, whether they're coronal mass ejections or garden variety flares, enhance the amount of solar radiation. They don't diminish it. So this could have been, you could have seen one of those wacky websites that take real science and then go off and get a little bit hysterical about it. As the sun rotates, we are in a period now of more activity than we've had in a while. It's kind of fun because we're waiting for a good display of the aurora borealis. Today is the full moon. Tomorrow is going to be close enough to the full moon that the sky will be too bright. But after that, for the next 10 days or so, skies will be perfect. And we're going to have another patch of really good dark skies coming up in December. It would be nice for us to get a beautiful aurora. We have not seen one since the great autumn displays of 2000 and 2001. This is the time of solar max. And so they're kind of overdue. And in our area, we sometimes get fabulous ones. So I hope you're right. I hope there are massive flares when they occur. And if you have a way to watch the sun with proper eye protection, like welder's goggles number 12 or 14, or any other solar filters you may have used for a partial eclipse, any spot large enough to see with the naked eye that happens to be in the very center of the sun, or within 2 or 3 days of solar rotation to the right of it, or west of it, that's when such a flare is positioned to send material, broken bits of atoms, plasma, in our direction. So we can pretty much see them coming and predict them, and let's keep our fingers crossed.
Okay, and the X1 flare, we would not really like to be in the direct...
Right.
Direct path of, and that's the fear, right?
Yeah, an X1 flare could really do damage. 1859, we had one, and then again in 1921, both of those were so strong that if they happened today, they could do $1 trillion worth of damage to our electrical grids. On March 13th, 1989, we had that great coronal mass ejection that knocked out. One-third of the population of Canada was without electricity.
Yeah.
So those things could happen, yes.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. The email address here is voxpop@wamc.org. And Bob, here's one that Nancy writes. Last year, the moon was full on my birthday. I tried to find out on the internet what year the moon would next be full on my birthday and could not find the answer. Any suggestions?
Well, I'm surprised because if you do your search again, because you should be able to get lunar calendars and phase of the month calendars for years and years and years to come. I use a reference, a big, thick reference, Jean Mayeux's astronomical tables of the moon, sun, and planets, and this goes off into the distant future.
Mm.
And I'll use that to find phases and stuff going off any year I want. But I'm sure you can find that on the internet.
Isn't that in the... Farmer's Almanac?
It is, but the Farmer's Almanac, of course, the 2015 issue just came out. And I think Nancy wants to look ahead,
in the
maybe.
Future.
Yeah.
I bet there's a program that'll do that for you. Dan in the Berkshires. Dan, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Bob, you had said that time passes more slowly at the surface of the Earth than it would on top of Mount Everest. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
My question is, wouldn't the mass of Mount Everest negate that effect, at least somewhat?
Oh, yeah. This is a wonderful point you're making, and that is it's the gravitational field that really determines the passage of time as well as speed. So you've got a number of factors, and we have to deal with this with the GPS that most of us use in our cars. GPS is time-based. The 24 satellites that make up the GPS system are essentially atomic clocks, and the unit in our cars pick up the time signals and determine if they're wrong, if they're delayed. And so anything that affects the passage of time will make the GPS not work correctly. So built into it, there are six different corrections for things like what you're talking about. The rotation of Earth, if you're located where Earth spins at its fastest rate near the equator, time will pass differently from those at a high latitude. If you're in a deep valley, it'll pass differently from a mountain. The clocks themselves are in orbits that are elliptical, and that changes the speed of the GPS satellites, so their clocks speed up and slow down. There's the Sagnac effect. There's all sorts of effects.
They're not in geosynchronous or orbit?
No, they're not. They're only 12,000 miles up ray instead of the 22,300 of geosynchronous.
Why are they not?
Because they're designed to slowly cross the sky in a period of one day, whereas, as you well know, geosynchronous stays in one spot all the time. And the reason for this is so that it'll be at least three, and preferably four different satellites within view of everybody all the time.
Makes sense.
Rather than being glued over the equator.
That's why you need 24.
Yeah.
Coverage the whole.
And so all these things change the passage of time. Of course, we don't worry about that if we all hang out in the same gravitational field like, you know, everyone you knew in high school did. Or if you're not traveling too fast, which, you know, even if you've, in your wildest joyride moments of being a teenager, none of us went any kind of fraction of the speed of light. So as long as you're not doing that, you're never going to notice it. But thanks to the atomic clocks, even the standard ones, which break every second up into, and listen, every time fanatic knows this number, 9,192,631,770 beeps per second. That's the official definition of an atomic second, of 1 second, or that many oscillations of an atom of cesium, the nucleus of cesium, per second. And that defines the second, because that's so accurate, we can tell these differences, even from a six-story building roof to the floor below. And so it's a different ballgame now.
Let's go over to Brian in Northampton, Mass. Brian, you're on.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
My question was about something that you said earlier. You said that they're starting to think more and more that the universe cannot exist independently of an observer. And I was wondering if that indirectly means that life existed beyond Earth as early as the beginning of the universe.
Well, it does. It brings up all sorts of freaky things. This is sort of the basis of the book Biocentrism I co-wrote with Dr. Robert Lanza, who's now really famous because he was in Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. So much so, we're going to do another book and exploit his new fame. The idea there, but it's not even an original thought. We didn't write anything original. This goes back to, if you want to get out of science, it goes back to essentially basics of Eastern thought or Eastern religion. It's the basics of quantum mechanics, where the observer influences what's seen. You know, when you're looking for an electron, is it a real object in a real place? No. Depending upon the observer, only looking at it causes this blurry probabilistic item to collapse to become an actual object in a real place, or to have a certain amount of motion, never both. And it's all dependent on the experiment and on the observer. So carrying this further looks as if that the observer and nature are correlative, that we go together. But boy, do you run into a can of worms with this kind of stuff, because it heads towards solipsism, which is that there's a single entity in the universe. And how are we going to deal with that? I seem to be separate from Ray here in the studio, and you seem to be in a different part of the area altogether. How can there be a single consciousness? That makes no logic. You know, that there's no logic to that. So you really get outside of the, not just the mainstream of science, but any way to make logical sense of it all, although it has its own separate logic to it.
Brian, thank you very much for the call. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. All right, let's go over to Greg in Western Mass. Greg, you got about a minute before the break.
I just want to piggyback on the last caller and throw out the idea that consciousness may actually exist in a field, that we've been looking desperately for in the mechanistic sort of scientific biochemical field of study to find memory traces that are strictly biological. And with all the advances in the last 10 years, especially in things like dark matter and dark energy, I'm wondering what your thoughts are in terms of, you know, why is it so far-fetched to think that possibly, you know, our consciousness exists outside of our, you know, our biochemical makeup, since we are discovering fields all the time. I'm going to hang up and listen to your response. Thanks.
All right. Well, I don't, and I can't really rebut. Do you want to take this after the break? Is that what
no? He said he's going to hang up, but okay. You go ahead, and then we'll take a break in 30 seconds. So
okay.
Answer this extensive question in 28 seconds. Go.
No, I wouldn't rebut that at all. What's internal and what's external is already kind of a marginal. When we look around the room, we all assume that the stuff on the other wall is outside our bodies. And yet any physiology textbook will tell you that what you're seeing is the inside of your brain, the occipital lobe of the brain, where all images are formed and perceived. So if that's your mind, if that's your brain out there that we assume is the external world, I mean, where do you draw the line? Where does it end, really?
Well, I know where we're going to take a break. It's right now. I see Zach. I think that's Zach. It might be my brain. 1-800-348-2551. I hope my brain doesn't look like that.
Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Winslow Homer, The Nature and Rhythm of Life, through January 4th, 2015, arkellmuseum.org. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. And Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Supporting the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy, InterimHealthcare.com.
You know, every once in a while we have one of these Bob Berman shows where things just get totally out there. And we were out there from before the show started, and here we are. This is from Jamie via email. Do you think it's more likely that we travel to other realities through intergalactic or dimensional means, warp speed or wormholes?
Bob? Well, I don't know what other realities would be. We were going all the way out there with whether time exists and whether the mind and the universe are correlative. But there's still a big part of scientists and me that is leery of anything that's not provable or testable or falsifiable.
Yeah.
And some of my friends and colleagues say that, you know, they poo-poo string theory. We've talked about this, Ray.
Because you can't test it.
You can't test it. And if you're not testing, it's just mind stuff. So when you ask questions about other realities, other dimensions, unless you can specify them or give some evidence that they exist, then, you know, we're just guessing and, you know, I could just make stuff up.
All right. Well, feel free. Let's go to Bob in Beckett, Mass. Bob, you're on with Bob Berman.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've been wrestling with this time situation for a long time. Long time. I didn't mean that. But is there a difference between time and duration? I mean, we do measure the half-life of various elements, and science seems to believe in that. We do recognize passage of time in rings on the growth of trees and stuff. If a child is born, we can predict that after certain durations, the child will grow. And as far as it being observed, if you put an onion in the refrigerator and close the door, although it's not being observed by anyone, when you open the door, you can imagine that and see that the onion will deteriorate and start rotting, even though it's not being observed by a human being. How do we deal with time as related to these things? Duration.
Well, you're right about that. Let me take the onion in the refrigerator thing first.
Okay.
Because, again, according to quantum theory, an onion made up of countless atoms, each of those atoms are in a state, a probabilistic kind of blurry-ish state, where upon the next observation, their wave function, which is how John Bell would have put it in the 60s, will have collapsed to probably be in the same position in which you remember it. But there's still a chance, a non-zero chance, that they will occupy unlikely positions. Now, the chance of all the onion atoms simultaneously occupying unlikely positions when you next observe it are very tiny, probably smaller than the lifetime of the planet. But it's possible, this is what quantum theory tells us, it's possible, not impossible, that when you open up the refrigerator, that onion's not there anymore. And it's the atoms have rematerialized maybe in some bedroom in Burma somewhere.
How can you intuitively feel that to be true?
You can intuitively, but when we actually do experiments and we see the unlikely materializations of a small, see, it's all done statistically, of a very small percentage of objects, we see this to be the case. So things are usually where we expect them to, but things we would have said are impossible some time ago are no longer really impossible. But our caller's central point was about time and duration. And this whole realm of time, of course, is useful and valid. And the question of whether our thoughts about it, and when we write stuff down, our thoughts are occurring, our neural electrical events occurring in the present moment. What we write down is occurring in the present moment. So the distinction between whether there really is a past and really is a future, or just events in the present moment that you could say happen eternally, an eternal now or eternal present moment. You could scribble down that there was the tree ring and then come back later and notice it's different and say that was on May 2nd and now I'm here on November 13th. That's undeniable that we make these observations. So we're talking about something that in a way is a subtle distinction from that and in another way is a very profound difference from that. But nobody would negate what you're talking about, what the caller is talking about, that we see these cyclical events that repeat in cycles that we're making note of. In fact, science depends on it.
All right, let's go to Caroline in Woodstock. Caroline, you're on. Oh, you got to turn your radio down a little bit to Caroline. All right, I'll give you a second to turn it down. Hello? She's gone, Zach? Okay, yeah, we can't do that. I'm sorry, Caroline. If you're listening at home, turn the radio down and call us back. Let's go over to Donald in Red Hook. Donald, you're on.
Hi, I live in Red Hook, New York, and I have a place up in Maine, Cassine, way up by the Canada border.
All right.
And I have the illusion that when I look up in the night sky in Maine, the stars seem brighter than they are in Red Hook. Is that an illusion or is that true?
No, I think you're absolutely right, because although Red Hook is a lovely place, the Mid-Hudson Valley has a certain amount of light pollution, and that means that there's a background glow to the sky that your eyes get accustomed to. Now, even on the darkest possible skies, the stars are five times less bright than the background of the sky. People don't realize that, but you know how on a moonless night, you can see your way through along a trail as long as there are no overhanging trees that are blocking the light of the sky. So the sky has a glow to it called air glow, mostly caused by ultraviolet from the sun during the day, and it gives off this glow like a miniature aurora at night, and that produces a background glow. Now the question is, how much more is there imposed on that? And that's where light pollution comes from. And Red Hook is not a super dark place, but northern Maine, you're going to get a lot of snow up there tonight, it looks like.
Yep.
Northern Maine, that's another story. And the background is so dark that the stars look definitely a lot brighter from there. I kind of envy you that you go up there and have those beautiful conditions.
Donald, thanks a lot for the call. Well, you mentioned this in the first chapter of your book, Zoom, where the sighting of telescopes. And so in the 20s or 40s, I guess, 20s to 40s, They moved west, and there were no more new telescopes of large size on the east of the Mississippi.
That's right.
And in California, by the time the 30s roll around, the sky has already gotten so bright due to man's activities, they had to move far south.
That's right. And nowadays, there's another consideration. That is, you really want very, very steady air. It's not just dark skies. You do want dark skies, but you want a place where the stars do not twinkle. And that means the layers of air above you. Not just moisture. In fact, moisture is a little good for that, to keep the seeing condition steady. You want a place where there's no variations in temperature, where there's a uniform temperature above your head. And you get that above the inversion layer. And in places like Chile, where the inversion layer is only 1,000, 2,000 feet above the surface, these mountains in the Andes, 8,000 feet up, have just stunningly steady skies. So that instead of the image being all blurry, any of you who have backyard telescopes know that stars are usually dancing, multicolored little blurs.
Yeah.
And craters on the moon often look blurry, not sharp. And what changes that are those fairly rare nights that we have here where the air is not so much transparent, but has the same temperature overhead and steady seeing. And that's what astronomers are looking for these days.
All right, let's go to David in Glenmont. David, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Turn my radio off.
Good plan.
I'm just was intrigued by the idea that time itself is largely a human construct. I'd never really thought about it that way before. And it makes me wonder about how we experience time. During a crisis, such as something happens fast and quick, like a car accident, time effectively slows down. You remember a lot more detail, and things slow down. And that on the other end of this would be someone who's maybe manic depressive and in their manic state can accomplish a huge amount of work in a very short period of time. So is the clock itself driven by our brain, by our mind?
Well, sure. The perception of time seems to be, this is outside my field, of course, but a lot of people notice that their childhood years, let's say from 4 to 14, that decade seems like forever. Seems like it took forever. And you take the same 10 years from, let's say, 56 to 66, feels like past in a snap of a finger. And the perception of time certainly varies with our consciousness. And but even scientifically, there's no real need for it in science. Even Newton's laws, Kepler's laws, the equations of relativity, even the quantum mechanics, they're time symmetrical. They don't require the use of time. And the only area that seems to is the second law of thermodynamics, what many of us think of as entropy, the process of going from order to disorder, like you have a glass of soda water and you come back a little later and it's flat. That only happens in one direction. You go from structure, in this case separate bubbles and separate, to sameness. And the temperature, the glass may have been one temperature, the soda may have been another. You come back later and now it's evened or randomized itself out. So because that's a one-way process, it's been argued that here is an arrow of time, a directionality of things happening. And as long as you have an arrow, it argues for time's existence. But more recently, others have said there's no arrows at all. It's just randomly the bubbles, the air temperature, all of these things are randomly occurring in the present moment, and no need for time or for arrows there either.
Don't we need some structure in order to have any sort of progress in our thinking?
We do. And of course, you know, I couldn't have come here at the time I was supposed to without looking at my watch, and we all use that for lots of purposes. And so nobody would argue that it's not indispensable for our lives even our perceptions. So what we're doing is going a little deeper here and seeing whether that is indeed a human structure or whether time is a separate dimension, a container that objects move through, that stands apart from the events in the universe, stands apart as an actual item. And that's what's being doubted.
So how would you test something like this? Now, you talk about string theory being provable, untestable. How would you test something like that?
Well, if time doesn't exist, you really can't test something that's just a structure that we use in our minds, a way of structuring things. For example, that would be like saying, how do you test your numbering system? you can't test the numbering system. It's a system that we create.
But you left the door open saying there is a school of thought that says time is a separate entity, another dimension, as Darwin, who said that?
Well, and Newton said Newton. That, and he was a smart guy.
Not Darwin, obviously. Yeah, Newton. Yeah. Let's go to Mike in Middletown. Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
My question is actually, when you were talking before in reference to time and so on, I understand that time certainly is a human concept. And based on theories of time or how it exists, does it mean that if we're closer to gravity, if there's more gravitational pull, then time slows down? And as we move away from gravity, then time speeds up. Does that do anything to the aging process of anything around it?
Yeah, absolutely. The astronauts on the moon aged more quickly than those back home. I don't think anyone gave them early Social Security benefits for that. But and here's a good question for you. If time slows down in a gravitational field, then as you go up higher and higher and want to orbit the Earth, let's say, astronauts orbiting the Earth, you should be in a faster and faster time. But on right. the other hand, you're moving in orbit relative to those on the ground. And so doesn't that motion do the opposite thing and slow down the passage of time? And the practical question for this is, how do the clocks, if they had careful atomic clocks on board the International Space Station, we're talking about being about 240 miles up, how would that compare to atomic clocks running on the ground? And it turns out that as you go up higher and higher, your clocks actually, because of the orbital speed, your clocks slow down up to 2,000 miles up. And nobody orbits higher than that. As you get beyond that point, it starts speeding up because the lack of gravity compensates for the different orbital speeds. You're actually at a slower orbital speed as you get higher, so that on the moon, time passes faster than it does back on Earth.
But now, to be clear, you're talking about a physical device that is measuring time.
And your body could serve as that physical device. If you stayed on the moon, you know, you're still only talking about perhaps the change, and I'm guessing this here, the change of perhaps a second over the course of a two-month mission. So it's not that you'd be visibly aging, but principle is there. And if you went to an object with either much stronger or weaker gravity or a much different speed until you get to, let's say, 90, again, using that rate of 99% of the speed of light, about 184,500 miles per second, and your time dilation factor would be 7 there. So that 1 week seems to pass for you while a day passes for someone else relative to you. So that there's a very different passage of time. And when you return to Earth after your mission, you both very much disagree on how much time passed. You both would have different ages. You would look, one would have aged quite a bit differently than the other would have aged. And then you'd look into each other's eyes and see that this stuff isn't just abstract and intellectual.
But really, wait, this is only because there are strontium atoms or there are cesium atoms that are measuring time. The time itself flows regardless of whether it is measured, or does measurement make, in other words, does time not exist if it is not measured?
Well, the passage of events still changes. For example, the beating of a heart, or the ticking of a metronome, or a pendulum of a grandfather clock, that changes differently. So as I said, you and I would look to be very different in age. If one of us traveled out in space at that speed and continued on back, we would be aging at a much, much slower rate than the other person. So we'd come back. If we both started in childhood, one of us could be 70 years old and look it, and the other one could be 12 years old and look it. And so then you'd see it's not an abstract thing at all. It's actually a difference in how events unfold, including the aging of our bodies.
I think we all have time backwards. And unfortunately, we're out of time. When you can figure that one out on your own. Bob Berman, thanks a lot for being here. That was strange, wasn't it?
It always is. Thank you.
Support for WAMC comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Edward Gar Bosick, certified financial planner serving all of Western Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. Ed at HavikinWealthStrategies.com. And Nature Logs, nature photography by Scott Stoner and Denise Hackert Stoner, photo sales, note cards for the holidays, slide presentations and workshops, bringing you the beauty of nature. NatureLogs.com. Thanks again for being here today. A very strange edition of Astronomy with Bob Berman. Zach Malloy was our very strange engineer. Your calls were answered by Mary Vetter. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday. Now, we are really out of time, if there in fact is such a thing. Stay tuned for news, or maybe not.